From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Mike Pesca. On Tuesday, George Bush gave the biggest speech of his presidency not related to terrorism. Plastered behind him dozens of times were the words corporate responsibility. If that's the message that sticks, then Bush will have won the day. If, on the other hand, citizens hunger for the similar but harsher phrase corporate reform, the Bush appeal will be overrun by congressional proposals that go far beyond what Bush advocates to rebuild confidence in the nation's business. Those were the stakes, and here to dissect the message is David Frum, who coined many a familiar phrase as a White House speechwriter during the first 14 months of the current Bush presidency. David Frum, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So were you waiting for Bush to call Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco the axis of malfeasance?
That might have been a little bit over the top. You know, this issue in many ways presents him with very unusual political problems. This is a war president who's now been yanked back out of what he thinks is important and what probably his political base thinks is important to deal with an issue that he thinks is secondary.
Before the speech, he had a pre-speech press conference where he talked about some of the issues that he was going to talk about the next day. What's the purpose of such a pre-speech speech?
Well, you know, if you bring the press into the room, read a half an hour speech at them, and then ask them to report on it, they're going to get a lot wrong. You want to give them a day to digest it. He also, I think, wanted to deal early with some of the more personal questions that people are going to have. One of the arguments that's being made by some of the president's critics and some of the press is that because of the president's own background in business, because he himself was at one point the subject of an SEC investigation, he somehow crippled or tainted in dealing with the issue of corporate malfeasance. So he wanted to answer those questions. I think the problem he had was he was not prepared for how many questions there would be and how fierce they would be. And so at that press conference, he did not turn in as successful a job as I think he would have liked.
Let's talk about Harkin for a second. It never tripped up Bush before. He's dealt with it in previous gubernatorial and the last presidential election. Do you think the White House is truly scared of the issue now?
I don't think they're scared of the issue. I think in his mind, he doesn't see that he did anything wrong. He doesn't think that he has anything to worry about, and he doesn't think that there's anything new to add to the story. So when the press is there in full what did you know and when did you know it mode, I think he was surprised by that. He was unprepared. He was unready. And that's certainly a mistake, because dealing with the press is like dealing with an angry dog. I mean, the moment they sense weakness, that's it.
On to the speech. Usually in a big speech, a president takes a stand and there are clearly delineated issues to have stem cell research or not to have stem cell research. Here, there are actually two big issues. It's to consider the few bad apple theory or to consider the systemic reform theory. Bush pretty much just said that this was a few bad actors causing these corporate scandals. And he didn't really engage at all in this other theory that's out there. Why didn't he feel the need to even engage that point that there are these people who are calling for broader reforms?
Well, that's not how presidents talk. The stem cell speech, which you refer to, is actually a very unusual speech. I mean, in that speech, President Bush entered into the details of an argument. Some say this, others say that. Here's my answer. That's not the way presidents normally communicate. They present their point of view, and then it stands or falls.
By framing the issue as we just have to go after the malefactors and then we'll have our solution, and by getting people to talk about it that way, is that Bush's sole objective?
This is one of those things where you have to accept not everything is about media, not everything is about framing. Some things are actually about hard facts. If by the time this is all said and done, we discover a dozen bad companies, not more, and those people are apprehended and punished in some way, people say, yep, the bad apple theory was right. If it turns out there are hundreds and hundreds of companies or dozens and dozens that have been doing this, then people will call for some more systematic reforms.
I know one tool of focus groups are those dial meters where every second of a speech can be registered as good or bad by people watching it. It struck me that during the Bush speech, right up there on the screen on the cable channel that I watched, there was the equivalent of a dial meter. It was that little arrow indicating whether the market was up or down. When he began the speech, it was up. By the time he finished, it was down. You've been on the inside when a speech was occurring. Do you think that people on the inside were at least a little dispirited by that?
No doubt they're dispirited by the juxtaposition. It doesn't make for a good image. On the other hand, I don't think anybody would have imagined that that was actually a comment on the speech itself, because everyone who was buying and selling stocks that day had known for 24 hours what was going to be in the speech. So if the speech was going to depress stocks, the stocks would have fallen the day before.
Well, how about the next day when the Dow goes down almost 300? Do you think the White House was dispirited by that?
I think what is happening there is that Wall Street is registering its opinion about who, after the speech, it thought was likely to win the argument, the president or Congress. And my interpretation of that 300-point drop the following day would be that they listened to the reaction to the speech and said, this speech may not be enough to stop some of the bad things that we see in Congress, and that it's going to be a tougher market in the coming little while.
So what you're saying is that Wall Street wasn't reacting to the president's speech as a bad idea, but they were saying that the president's speech wasn't convincing enough to win the day and defeat the proposal that they truly hated. It was at least a referendum on the effectiveness of the speech, if not the content of it.
I think that's a good explanation. Now, remember, Wall Street always votes in like 5-minute increments.
Right.
So the next day they might change their mind. They will be, as this legislative process goes ahead, constantly assessing. And the president's speech is one factor, but there'll be a lot of others that give people in Wall Street the idea, are we going to see a better investment climate coming out of the changes from Congress, or is it going to be worse?
David Frum, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
David Frum is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He was a former speechwriter for President Bush and is writing a new book on him called The Right Man, The Transformation of George W. Bush.
On June 25th, Israel launched its Arabic-language satellite television channel. The Israeli cabinet minister responsible for the Israel Broadcasting Authority, which operates the station, says that it was meant to serve as a counterweight to the venomous propaganda that surrounds us. But editorials in newspapers from across the spectrum of Arab nations have dismissed what they say is transparent propaganda on the part of the Israelis. Adel Iskander is the co-author of Al Jazeera, How the Free Arab News Network Scooped the World and Changed the Middle East, and he joins us now from the University of Kentucky. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Now, Shibli Talami, the Middle East analyst who tracks Arab public opinion, said, if you don't trust the messenger, you don't trust the message. How can any Israeli media get around that seemingly unbreachable gulf?
I think the unbreachable gulf stems from the fact that there isn't a real commitment to the actual issues on the ground. The Arab audience is savvy enough, is media savvy enough to be able to understand where the message is coming from. They can look at it and they have a mental map. And this message originates from Israel, this message originates from Cairo, and they can figure that out themselves. And the same goes for a BBC broadcast or a Voice of America broadcast or even an Israeli broadcast.
Would any television or radio station that had on Israeli ministers, say, already be regarded as Zionist and pretty much untouchable politically just because they had those voices on?
There's no question about it. To even have an Israeli official on air in and of itself is an automatic accusation. It's pointing a spotlight on the network and questioning its intentions. Israeli television, when they do interview Palestinian Authority officials, they are criticized in the local papers as well. And so there's a general skepticism in the audience in that area of the world, whether they be Arab or Israeli.
What exactly can the Israelis do in order to get a message across that won't immediately turn off 9/10 of the Arab audience?
Well, actually, it really doesn't come down to the actual message. I mean, I think that the audience will always question the intentions of the Israelis so long as the land that was appropriated in 1967 is still under occupation. I mean, that is the bottom line. So they need to see a positive and very certain intention to create change on the ground, and then couple that with a media message that is more inviting and more moderate from the Israeli side as well.
So action before words.
Action before words, absolutely.
Recently, Arab information ministers met in Cairo to pledge more than $22 million for a media campaign targeting Israel. What do they have in mind, and will they have any more success than the Israelis will?
In simple terms, what they're planning to do is the other side of the coin. They're trying to target the Israeli public and open their eyes to the Arab perspective. There are moderate Israelis and left-wing Israelis that feel very strongly about the Palestinian cause and are supportive of a withdrawal of Israeli forces behind the 1967 lines. And so I think that they're hoping to appeal to that particular crowd. But whether or not they can change the right-wing policies in the Israeli cabinet is very, very, very unlikely.
Not until they take action, for instance, ending suicide bombers.
Absolutely.
So the actions first, words later principle holds true on both sides.
On both sides, absolutely.
But we always were taught that media changes everything.
That's a tough call. I mean, I think that the Middle East is probably an exception when it comes to that. I mean, it's one place that has been bombarded by so many different networks over the last 30, 40 years, whether they're clandestine, pirated networks. It's probably one of the most difficult places in the world to deal with when it comes to media. There's so many variable messages from different sources that it undermines anyone's single policy or agenda. There are very few networks that the Arab audience sees as credible, and those are the ones that every source should be taking advantage of. Unfortunately, it's the bin Ladens that have taken advantage of Al Jazeera. On occasions, it's been Condoleezza Rice or Donald Rumsfeld, but in the long run, it hasn't been a sustained effort to communicate with the Arab world through the venues that they find credible. And so long as we're not doing that, then we're really not getting our message across.
Adil, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Adil Iskander is the co-author of Al Jazeera, How the Free Arab News Network Scooped the World and Changed the Middle East.
And now for some of your letters. Librarian Virginia Walter appreciated our prodding of Phil Dusenberry, the man behind the new Freedom ad campaign. Especially, she writes, given the current curtailment of our civil liberties, including the government being able to snoop in patron records as well as watching people on the web. Frankly, the actions of the government are frightening to me and my friends, including other librarians. Mr. Dusenberry appears not to have considered that the ads would seem a little insincere from a government who seems ready to throw away civil rights at the slightest threat.
Bob Garfield's sojourn into the land of country music and what transpired there drew a wide range of comments. Some, like George Kreisberg of Los Angeles, wrote, "Next time someone asks me to define self-indulgent in its most virulent form, I will direct them to the OTM broadcast of July 7th, 2002, in which the regular co-host of the program spends nearly 20 minutes on a piece about becoming a country singer. Funny, I thought the broadcast was designed as a thoughtful hour about media and its flaws and foibles, not how I spend my off time on an out-of-town speaking engagement."
But most of the letters expressed what we could only call amazed delight. Like Joan Rothenberg of Arlington, Virginia, who wrote, "For those of us living inside the Beltway, involved in the workings of this now Texan-populated country-loving town, this piece was a true gem. Whenever I listen to this popular genre of music and think there's no way I can possibly relate to the horse-riding, fly-fishing, hard-drinking, truck-driving, heartbreaking culture, I now have hope. Congratulations to Bob on the start of his new career."
Please send your letters to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, cable beats broadcast for the first time, and what makes Bill O'Reilly really angry.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca, in for Bob Garfield. Last week, the Washington Post announced that it would appeal a decision of the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, currently trying cases of genocide in the former Yugoslavia. The court had subpoenaed former Post reporter Jonathan Randall to testify against a Bosnian Serb who he had once quoted in a story. In 1992, Peter Moss was a Post reporter in Bosnia and wrote about Bosnian warlord Milan Kovacevic. 5 years later, Moss agreed to testify before the tribunal. Kovacevic died before Moss actually took the witness stand. But when he first received the request, he faced an ethical conundrum.
Well, I guess my immediate reaction was surprise. I thought, well, these are war crimes trials that are going on, and we'll have the usual kinds of witnesses there, you know, meaning victims and perhaps some people on the inside who are willing to testify and then experts or whatever. I wasn't expecting to be called myself. In particular, with that incident that they wanted me to testify about, I hadn't expected that it would be something that could ever be regarded as crucial in a war crimes trial. But once I began thinking about it, I realized, well, okay, this is something that I can see how it might be useful for the War Crimes Tribunal, particularly as they didn't really have any kind of smoking guns with which they could put this fellow, Milan Kovacevic, into prison for the rest of his life.
But did you also begin to realize what it would mean for the profession as a whole or for you going to do your job on an ongoing basis? I guess the analogy would be towards the Red Cross doesn't want to testify because then they won't be invited in to administer whatever humanitarian aid they have to administer if they know they're going to be used to testify in a trial at a later date.
Right. Well, I think we need to kind of disassociate ourselves from, you know, theories that might exist at journalism school and the actual reality. I mean, the Red Cross is indeed a neutral organization and is generally regarded as such. Journalists in the field are rarely regarded by the people who they seek to interview when we're talking about wars and warlords as neutral. I mean, in fact, we're pretty much regarded as spies for our governments, even though that's not what we are. So it's not as though by having testified, you know, we will suddenly be regarded in a different way by the people who we're depending on to a certain extent for information and trying to get information from, which is not to say that testifying won't have any effect at all, because in my case, as in the case of other journalists who've been called to testify, in fact, once you do testify at this tribunal, it does become more difficult for you personally, not for the profession, I don't think, but for you personally to go back to the area where, for example, relatives or friends of the people you've testified against might live, because indeed they might know your face, they might know your name, and they will definitely regard you as having helped put their father or their friend into jail for the rest of his life.
If this were to be an established practice, could you see it having a chilling effect on trying to cover a war zone, trying to cover the people that the United States, for instance, is at war against?
Well, I think it would have a chilling effect if this was really a frequent occurrence. I mean, I'm only in favor of testifying really under two circumstances. That is, when the testimony is absolutely crucial to delivering justice in a war crimes trial, and only if, as well, the testimony won't endanger the life of the journalist himself or herself or their colleagues or friends. And those are actually two bars that are quite high, because the first one, in terms of the testimony being absolutely crucial, well, that eliminates a large number of journalists.
You've thought about this very much. Are you satisfied that the courts themselves have considered it as carefully as you have?
In fact, I know they've considered it because it's been brought up to them before. I just don't think they fully understand it. I mean, in the Randall case, which I know pretty well, it's pretty clear that what they wanted to testify about is really not absolutely crucial. And there are many other ways that they could get this information into the courtroom without having to drag a reporter there. What this man told to Randall was reported in Randall's story, so they can use that as evidence if they want to.
And how American courts deal with this is they typically just have a reporter certify that what was printed he stands by and leave it at that.
Also, though, I wouldn't draw a parallel too closely between, you know, the relationship between American reporters and American courts and the relationship between journalists and the Hague Tribunal, because, you know, in my view, I just think that we're not talking about grand larceny, we're talking about genocide. So I think some of the moral considerations really do tip the scales when you're talking about mass murder rather than individual murders or less than that.
Does the split among reporters on whether to testify or not to testify, does it split along lines, something like American reporters on one side, Europeans on another?
That is one of the splits, definitely European reporters, because there's a much greater tradition of, let's say, involvement or activism in European journalism, tend to be more willing to testify. And there are a lot of journalists here who say, you know, just as journalists should not testify or cooperate with law enforcement authorities here in America, the same goes for international authorities, even if the crimes that we're talking about are genocide.
And I would assume that one of the considerations goes to the whole reason of why you'd want to force yourself to cover a situation like genocide, which is to, if not testify in the legal sense, in the colloquial sense, to tell the world about the realities of what was going on. And I would also assume that if you wouldn't testify and someone that you covered who committed what you judged to be acts of genocide got away with it, you'd feel pretty terrible, right?
Well, absolutely. I think the work of the tribunal is very much a continuation in many respects of the work and the mission that a lot of journalists have. So if I can help that process without hurting myself or hurting my colleagues, I'm willing to do that.
Peter Moss, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Moss covered the war in Bosnia for the Washington Post, and he wrote Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War.
Last month, and for the first time ever, cable TV drew more viewers than network TV in primetime. Cable networks registered a 54 primetime share for June, about 31 million homes, as opposed to a paltry 38 share and 22 million homes for the seven major broadcast networks. The biggest cable winners were TNT, followed by USA and Lifetime. Here to put all those letters and numbers into context is our old friend Max Robbins, who writes the Robbins Report for TV Guide. Welcome back, Max.
Hey, Brooke.
So, does this mean that cable has finally conquered broadcast TV, or are these numbers misleading?
No, these numbers aren't misleading at all. Cable, for some time, has really been chipping away at that major broadcast network share of the audience. And this is indeed a watershed number.
But it is a tribute also to narrowcasting, because you're talking, what, about 60-some cable stations versus seven networks?
Absolutely. However, what's interesting to note is there are a number of shows on cable who have ratings now that are approaching broadcast levels.
And this is pretty new, that the highest rated cable show is now approaching or even surpassing the ratings for the lowest rated network shows.
It really is unusual that, for example, you have a show like The Osbournes on MTV that does numbers pretty close to what some networks would be happy with, quite frankly. Other shows like on FX, The Shield. There's an original Stephen King series on USA that's doing quite well.
How do people find out about these programs?
Some of these cable networks are owned by these major media companies that can market them across platforms. A company like Viacom, which controls all the MTV networks, MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, the National Network, they can advertise that on all these radio networks they control. They're getting quite effective at getting the word out.
What about word of mouth? Is it more important for cable than it is for networks? Is viral marketing at work here, as they call it?
Viral marketing is crucial. Shows that just get kind of a water cooler buzz going. I mean, in the sense that was what happened with the Osbournes. MTV didn't know they had lightning in a bottle with that. The other thing, too, is you're dealing now with an audience that we talk about, that demographic that's so attractive to Madison Avenue, 18 to 34-year-olds. Most people in that group, they're very comfortable with cable. They don't have the same kind of viewer loyalty, maybe an older demographic once did to the broadcast networks.
What kind of impact do these ratings figures have, since, as you say, the biggest numbers for TV shows are still in network TV?
It's having an impact for cable as a whole in selling itself, its worth, its value to advertisers, saying you've got to pay the same kind of premium for our audience that you do for the broadcast networks.
How have the networks responded to this gradual erosion of its audience to cable?
In one sense, it's almost this kind of, if you can't beat them, join them. If you look at the broadcast networks this summer, they're looking a whole lot like cable television. You watch ABC, you think you're watching the Discovery Channel. I mean, one of the big breakout hits of the summer on Fox, American Pop Idol, it looks like an MTV show. A lot of these shows are drawing a young audience who's been weaned on this stuff on cable.
So do you think this trend is going to continue? As cable channels proliferate, they'll just drain more and more audience from the seven networks?
Absolutely. There's no stopping this. There will be the occasional breakout hit that the networks have, but cable will continue to chip away at the broadcast network audience. And it's going to be harder and harder for broadcast networks to deliver that blockbuster. And what's going to happen is, for mass marketers, because there'll be fewer and fewer shows that do deliver that huge audience, those shows that do will become increasingly valuable.
The ER phenomenon.
The ER Friends phenomenon, absolutely.
I've been reading that the USA Network is launching a new show starring Tony Shalhoub called Monk, and that they're hoping it'll be their Sopranos. They're looking to another cable channel for their model of success, not to networks.
You mentioned the Sopranos. HBO in that 9 o'clock time slot on Sunday night has become a real factor that the networks take into account. A lot of the producers of big dramas, they don't want to be on at 9 o'clock where they're going to be up against a Sopranos or a Six Feet Under.
Maybe Six Feet Under is an appropriate place to end this interview.
Don't bury the broadcast networks yet, Brooke, but their business certainly has changed, and cable's going to keep chipping away at what they do.
Max, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brooke.
Max Robbins writes the Robbins Report for TV Guide.
What kids tune into and why are big questions for TV producers, parents, and culture critics. Last summer, we decided to ask a teenager to track her media consumption on a typical day. Here's a replay of the media diet of 16-year-old Janice Nieves of the South Bronx, beginning with the moment she opens her eyes.
I hate that buzzer. I really do. So I turn it off as soon as I wake up and leave the radio on.
I always sleep with the radio. I can't sleep without it for some reason.
Up next on Hot 97.
I turn to Hot 97's morning show with Star and Buck Wild. Star calls himself a hater, but he just speaks his mind about everyone. That's all.
I went on a date with somebody, called him up a week later, and says, well, who's this? I said, Star. Call me a beautiful daughter. She said, you mean my 16-year-old daughter? I said, whoa! Whoa!
You know, I'm trying to be like that, especially in school. Like, not caring what anybody think, not being afraid to sit in class or raise your hand and say something when you want to say it, even if it sounds stupid. But then, you know, sometimes he does go overboard.
Anyway, folks, coming up at 7:20, I have a sincere apology in regards to Aaliyah.
Let me tell you, on Monday, after Aaliyah died, you know, that singer and actress who was killed in a plane crash, Star played these special effects, right? Sounds of a woman screaming while a plane goes down. It crashed, and then you didn't hear anything. After that, his co-host walked out on him, and I don't blame her. Then he actually played it again. As one of her fans, I was mad as hell. But the next day, he apologized.
Yeah, I can apologize to Aaliyah's family and her friends, and your Hot 97 listeners. Sure, I can apologize. That's nothing that's beyond me.
I accepted his apology. And anyway, my last memory of Aaliyah won't be a sound effect. It'll be her music. I remember when that song came out. I kept playing it over and over again. I used to get in front of the mirror and make believe I was one of her dancers. She was real smooth. She made me feel like I didn't have to try hard. I could just be me. Cartoon time! In the summer, I watched all the cartoons I missed during the school year, like Rugrats. You're so cute.
Angelica!
Oh, hello, Daddy.
Angelica, didn't Daddy specifically explain to you about 100 times how important these papers are?
Yes, Daddy. I'm so sorry. I'll never do it again.
After a while, though, cartoons get boring. And I start to realize, unlike the Rugrats, I'm getting older. And I can't get away with everything. On the number 5 express train into Manhattan, if you don't have music or something to read, you look up and see all these ads. This is one that always seems to catch my eye. It says, Fast Track to Who You Want to Be. And it shows all these college graduates. That's going to be me one day. When I get home, the PlayStation is always on. I've got to remind my brother that he needs a life. I go and see if my mother has the newspaper.
Do you have the paper? You didn't buy the paper? What's going on?
Anyway, at least there's always the internet. The internet is one place I know I can count on to get the story on what's up with the world.
Fans remember Aaliyah, 22-year-old R&B singer killed in a plane crash.
It's also fun to surf the net and check things out. I like to go to a site called diamondsforever.com, where you can customize your own engagement rings. How fat is that? I'm not engaged or anything. I just like to imagine all the diamonds I'll have in the future. Then I go to a website called ontheline.org. It's where I go to speak my mind about different topics, like that song, Because I Got High by Afro Man.
I was gonna clean my room until I got high. I was gonna get up and find the broom, but then I got high.
Some people think the song encourages teens to get high. I don't think so. I think he's trying to say not to.
I messed up my entire life because I got high.
Look what he lost by getting high.
I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what, say what, say what, say what. Now I'm
sleeping. Lying in my bed, listening to the radio. I'm by myself. But I feel like people are listening to my thoughts. Somehow, everything seems meant for me. Star of Hot 97 knows I hate that buzzer. So he comes on to make me laugh. When Afro Man sings, I feel like he knows that my father was a drug addict. And when Aaliyah says, if at first you don't succeed, dust yourself off and try again,
It makes me think about the 2 years I wasted not going to high school. I'm going back this fall to try again. People are always asking, are we alone in this world? I think not. For On the Media in the Bronx, I'm Janice Nieves. Dust yourself off and try again. You can dust it off and try again.
Much has been said about missing Utah teen Elizabeth Smart. Much has also been said about the press coverage being far out of proportion to the national importance of the story and far in excess of the hundreds of other children who go missing. Add to the list of media critics the fair and balanced voice of Fox's Bill O'Reilly, who took CNN's Larry King to the woodshed for too much coverage of Elizabeth Smart.
I watched just a few minutes of that and became angry. Mr. King is exploiting this young girl's tragedy for ratings, and he's doing pretty well with it. If there's news to report, fine, that's our job. But sitting around for hours speculating is a perversion of the news process.
Viewers could rest assured that unless there was an entirely fact-based update, The Factor would be both a no-spin zone and a no-smart zone. O'Reilly made that pledge at 8:03 Eastern Time on Thursday. At 8:12, he said this.
In the Factor follow-up segment tonight, authorities in Salt Lake City have charged 48-year-old Richard Reese with theft for breaking into the home of Elizabeth Smart a year ago.
It would be all too easy to ask just how little credit does O'Reilly give his audience, to think that he can enter into an anti-Smart coverage rant 1 minute and 9 minutes later engage in the very same king-like ratings grovel. But let's be fair. What O'Reilly specifically said was that you could report the facts, just don't engage in rumor and speculation.
Cops figured, I believe, that they had him on, you know, basically locked up all this time, so there was no real hurry. I heard as early as this week they were even going to wait further down the road to file these charges. But now, I guess, since they've got him, they're going to file these charges, and also it's pretty tame stuff overall.
I believe, I heard, I guess. Okay. If a guest speculates, that's one thing. But O'Reilly draws the line at engaging in it himself.
And counselor, it looks to me like they think this guy did it and they're just squeezing him.
True, it would be easy to mock O'Reilly's stance as self-serving, insulting, that King's the kettle and O'Reilly's a pot and the charge of inky blackness is wafting in the air. But I refrain. In fact, I'll give Bill the last word and let the folks decide.
Again, I condemn speculation at the top of this program in the Talking Points of Memo. But we have you guys on because you can read the case.
That's Bill O'Reilly. You can distinguish his coverage from Larry King's. He's the one without suspenders.
Coming up, 150 years of war reporting.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 1854, a London Times reporter named William Howard Russell became a star as the first famous war correspondent with this account of the British Light Cavalry Brigade against Russian gunners in Crimea.
At 10 minutes past 11, our Light Cavalry Brigade advanced. They swept proudly past, glittering in the morning sun in all the pride and splendor of war. With a halo of steel above their heads, and with a cheer which was many a noble fellow's death cry, they flew into the smoke of the batteries. But ere they were lost from view, the plain was strewn with their bodies. Through the clouds of smoke we could see their sabers flashing as they rode between the gunners as they stood. At 35 minutes past 11, not a single British soldier, except the dead and the dying, was left in front of the Muscovite guns.
Russell was seen as the first practitioner of a great tradition, war reporting. But when he looked back on it all, Russell called himself the miserable parent of a luckless tribe. The reason for that gloomy assessment can be glimpsed in a remark made by U.S. Senator Hiram Johnson in 1917. He said, "The first casualty when war comes is truth." Philip Knightley is author of the classic study of the foreign correspondent, The First Casualty. It's just been released in a new edition, updated for the first time since it was published 27 years ago. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why, when summing up his career, did Russell call himself the miserable parent of a luckless tribe?
I think he foresaw what was going to happen to that tribe. He foresaw that they would become, in their own way, propagandists for the government of the day. The military, who didn't like war correspondents right from the beginning, didn't want Russell along covering the charge of the Light Brigade because it brought home to a reading public, a greatly growing reading public, the horrors of warfare.
And it already began to change during Russell's career.
Yes, by the time that Russell was finished with the Crimea and moved off to the American Civil War, the power of the press with its war reporting had brought down a government in Britain and infuriated all the generals who up until then had reported their own wars.
Brought down the government in Britain?
Yes, the reports about the inefficiency of the supply requirements of the army, about the way that soldiers were left lying untreated, wounded on the battlefield, that led to Florence Nightingale going over to the Crimea in order to help these soldiers, brought down the government of the day.
Well, let's skip past the charge of the Light Brigade to the American Civil War. Now, the coverage there should have been extraordinary. Suddenly, reporters had access to this astounding new communications technology, the telegraph. But you write that it was covered miserably.
Yes, because already we can sense a certain corruption creeping in the way reporters reported. They began to realize their power. They began to charge various officers sums of money to give them a puff in the press, as they said.
But was that all? Was it simply that the reporters were after personal gain, or was there the politics of nations getting in the way?
Well, a lot was beginning to creep in. Politicians began to realize that nations fight as its people think, and that you can manipulate the way people think in wartime by clever manipulation of the war correspondents themselves.
Now, the twin forces of propaganda and censorship acquired a very modern efficiency during the First World War. Could you set the scene?
The scene was that the military by now, alarmed in the latter part of the 19th century at the power that war correspondents were displaying, revolted against having war correspondents around at all. And they announced that with the British Expeditionary Force to France to fight Germany, they would allow only 5 war correspondents, and they sort of incorporated them into the army. They said you can come if you can ride a horse, and that you will be given all the status of, say, a captain, and that you will have a batman and a driver and a personal censor, and we will show you what we think you should see. So you got none of the horrors of the First World War, you got none of the slaughter of the trenches. They said it's been a glorious day for Britain today, when in fact something like 100,000 people, 100,000 soldiers have been killed in one battle alone.
Now, that was a war when reporters signed on to the cause. They were committed to the Allied victory. But during the Spanish Civil War, there was a division between governments and among the press over who was right. There was no objectivity. There wasn't any middle ground. And most of the reporters sided with the Republicans.
They saw the fight there, the Republican government against the insurgents led by fascist General Franco, as being the beginnings of what later on became the Second World War.
Rumbling eastward this week from Aragon toward the sea in the mightiest offensive since the World War is the mechanized army of Spanish rebel General Francisco Franco. Tanks from the great German firm of Krupp, bombers from Italy's Caproni, Italian armored trucks, German heavy artillery, a crushing juggernaut that blasts its way through every loyalist defense, on toward the loyalist industrial center and seaport of Barcelona.
They saw the great battle developing between democracy and fascism, and felt that the Spanish Republican Army deserved to win.
And with the stakes so high, the first casualty is truth principle kicked in with a vengeance. And the reporters actively slanted their stories. They even made things up, both the pro-Republicans and the pro-fascists.
Yes. I mean, I can give you a good example of making things up. The denial of the bombing of Guernica. This was a bombing carried out by German planes working, fighting with the Franco-fascist.
Immortalized in the Picasso painting.
Indeed. There was a concerted move by the propagandists for the Franco side to make certain that the public got the view that this was an entirely invented story by pro-Republican reporters, and that what really happened there was simply that the people of Guernica had destroyed the town themselves in order to blame the German bombers for what had occurred.
On the pro-Republican side, you spend a fair amount of time on the journalist Claude Coburn, who is a fine writer, but you saw his Spanish War coverage as a disaster.
He admits himself that on one occasion he sat down with a Comintern officer and a map of a town so as to make certain that they got the details right, and they totally invented a battle, which was won by the gallant Republican army against the hordes of fascists who had been storming them. He became so attached to what he felt was the right side that he lied in order to put that side in the best possible light.
You quote him telling his wife, with regard to the public's right to the truth, he said, "Who gave such a right? Perhaps when they have exerted themselves enough to alter the policy of their bloody government and the fascists are beaten in Spain, they will have such a right. This isn't an abstract question, it's a shocking war."
Yes, that is, sums up very well the way that he felt about it. Later on, other correspondents have said that they feel that the public right to know and the public right to objective or fair reporting can come back when the war is over, but in the meantime it's necessary to win the war.
What about the coverage of World War II, the good war? From the standpoint of journalism, was it as good as all that?
No. I mean, I quote at the end of that chapter a Canadian war correspondent who'd been working for one of the big news agencies is saying, looking back after the war was over, he was appalled at what he'd written. He said, we weren't reporters, we weren't even historians, we were just propagandists for the Western side. But you see, in a war of national survival, it's very easy to get the journalist on side. You don't want to be accused of doing anything that might inhibit your government from winning what you and they consider to be a just war.
Departing almost to a split second on the right time, on a plan which they've been working and sweating and slaving at for months. The sky now is full of the noise of these paratroop planes as they circle the aerodrome before they take their course. But just as they're circling in the air, so the others that are waiting to go are circling the track of the aerodrome. Their lights moving round in a stately, steady procession. Aboard them are some of the toughest and finest and bravest men that we have in Britain. And they go out today to face their greatest trial.
At least the Germans avoided the hypocrisy of the Allied side, where the Allies pretended that these war correspondents were writing the truth and writing impartial reports and fair reports. The Germans simply herded all the war correspondents into a semi-army unit called a propaganda company and told them what to write.
Let's jump ahead to Vietnam. Now, that was the first time when reporters were actually accused of helping to hand victory to the enemy. Did they?
The American military certainly believes that's the case. I don't know what aberration occurred in the military mind in the Pentagon during the Vietnam War, but some aberration did occur because they decided they would trust the war correspondents to be on side. I mean, they'd been on side to a large extent in Korea, and they thought they would enjoy the same support from the press as they'd enjoyed there. So they just handed them on a platter a card that said, you can go anywhere you want. We will help you get there, we'll provide you with rations when you are there, and you can write anything you like. But we'll rely on you and your good sense and your patriotic duty to write the story as you see it. Well, it worked for a while because most American war correspondents there did feel that the war was a just one, but they began to object to the way in which the war was being waged.
The long, wearying, and oftentimes baffling war against communist rebels in South Vietnam swung sharply toward a new crisis today. For the first time in the years-long struggle, the scene of action has shifted from the jungles and rice paddies to the sea and involved naval craft instead of guerrilla fighters. Hard on the heels of an attack Sunday and in the face of a warning from Washington, North Vietnamese torpedo boats opened an attack on two United States destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin today.
The public back in the United States learnt the full truth about body counts, and they learnt the truth about assassination squads, and they learned the truth about the deaths of innocent people. They learned the truth about various American atrocities. And this so sickened the viewer and the reader that they lost the will to continue the war.
War reporting changed after Vietnam, didn't it?
Yes, it changed amazingly for the worse. What happened was that military chiefs all over the world looked at Vietnam and thought, what lessons can we learn from this? And at a conference held in the Royal United Services Institute in London in 1975, I think it was, attended by representatives of the Pentagon, the Ministry of Defense here, and a number of senior journalists, the question of, can we ever again allow color television cameras or any television cameras on the battlefield again and to cover a war no matter how just that war might be? And the conclusion was a resounding no. So from that moment on, the Pentagon and the Ministry of Defense worked on a plan to manage the media in wartime. And it turned out to be a very simple but very effective plan. The military now controls access to the war. And nobody is allowed there unless the military takes you or allows you to go.
Grenada, Panama,
yeah.
and the Gulf.
And the Gulf.
We've been receiving some late reports from Baghdad that it appears airports and military installations near the Iraqi capital have been hit. What do you say about that?
This strikes me as an orderly way of shutting a country down. We are making war at all of Saddam's most important war-making capacities. The one thing I am not hearing is that we are not apparently making war on the innocent civilians.
You call the Gulf War the video game war. That's because so much of what we remember of that coverage are the reporters sitting in the briefing room being regaled with pictures of smart bombs that turned out, in retrospect, to have been
less smart than we think, yes. The military made it very difficult for war reporters to get to the front to see what was happening. They were taken on little conducted tours that were, with the pool system, which all journalists hate, pool system being a group of reporters that are selected or self-selected, and they are required to report for the whole of the media. And they're conducted where the military thinks it's safe to let them go, and they're censored. The major American media organizations objected to this and considered bringing an action while the war was on, claiming that this infringed their right of freedom of expression. But then their own rivalry with among themselves led to the abandonment of that. And only the nation continued it, and by the time that they would have got a decision, the war was over. But the judge did rule that there was a case to answer.
Well, what about the coverage of Kosovo? There was plenty of reporting there that didn't suit government policy. There were some on-the-scene accounts. Was that finally good, unimpeded reporting?
Well, we're getting into a real minefield here about what is good, unimpeded reporting. Before the reporters got there, the government justification for what was happening had so demonized the Serbs that it became very difficult for any reporter not to join the mainstream stories of Serb atrocities. A lot of the war correspondents, mostly young and inexperienced, the quick story to do was, I witnessed an atrocity today, or I've discovered another mass grave. And they were known among the various independent interpreters there as the mass graves correspondents.
And so reporting was abundant, but it wasn't any good.
Yes, it's quite possible in wartime to say, well, we've been showered, inundated with material, but very little real information. You had to look around for an old Balkans hand who understood the centuries of animosity that led to what had occurred, and follow him or her in order to get a real idea of what was occurring.
Your book is studded with stories of lucky and courageous correspondents who found themselves in the right place at the right time and managed to get the story through. And a lot of what stood in their way was simply the technology of the era. We have myriad ways to get words from one continent to another and out in front of the public. Shouldn't it be easier now to evade the kinds of obstructions that governments put in front of war reporting?
I mean, satellite phones and position, navigational positioning devices and all that sort of thing make it much, much easier to get the story back. But what is the story? It is not difficult to manage the media in wartime. You deny them access. You provide them with almost unlimited information, but information that you want to get published. And you denigrate and slander any correspondent, like, for example, Peter Arnett, who attempted to report the war from the other side by staying on in Baghdad. Arnett was accused of being a traitor.
Well, Philip, I must say this has all been very reassuring.
Well, I know it's not very reassuring, but maybe we'll win through. But I'm afraid I'm a pessimist about the future of being war correspondents, unless there is some major change in the way that the governments and the military view them.
Well, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
Philip Knightley is the author of First Casualty, The War Correspondent as Hero and Mythmaker from the Crimea to Kosovo, now in a new updated edition.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katia Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Rob Weisberg, Irene Trudell, George Edwards, and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. Garfield comes back next week. We had help from Andy Lancet and Dan Bobkoff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. The Media Diet of Janice Nieves was produced by Marianne McCune.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Be sure to visit our website at onthemedia.org. You can get free transcripts, find web links related to stories we cover, listen to past shows, and a lot more. And email us with your thoughts and rants at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.